Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shri Kahoshri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premananda Devi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesa Sanyavani Paskatyade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutava Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Chubhishtaki Pasanthi Avatapti Chanam Pavaneva Vaishnavamayama Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. February 19th, 2017, in Perth, Australia, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 22, The Marriage of Kardama Muni and Devahuti, Text 19. Atobajisye samayena sadvim.
Today's 20th.
Krishna keeps getting me corrected here. Good for my ego. Yato bhavad vishramidam vichitram.
Yato bhavad vishramidam vichitram.
I know what I did. I looked at the date, which was 19. Okay, we're in text 20. Samsaya se yatra tavaististat chavavatistate.
Samsaya se yatra chavavatistate.
Prajapatinam patireshamayam.
Prajapatinam patireshamayam.
Param pamanam bhagavanananta.
Param pamanam bhagavanananta.
Yato bhavad vishramidam vichitram.
Yato bhavad vishramidam vichitram.
Samstasyate yatra chavavatistate.
Samstasyate yatra chavavatistate.
Prajapatinam patireshamayam.
Prajapatinam patireshamayam.
Param pramanam bhagavanananta.
Param pramanam bhagavananta.
Okay, let's just look at the Sanskrit for a minute. What does padam mean?
Fate.
Oh, that's padam.
Absolute, ultimate.
Or other or highest. And what does pramana mean? We talk about our pramanas. What do they mean?
Results.
Like that's prayojana.
Yeah, praman means
evidence.
Evidence.
Evidence. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you have as evidence? Bhagavan is.
Lord.
The Lord. Ananta.
The one who has no
end. End. Without end. So the supreme, my supreme evidence is the unlimited Lord. Basically. Yataha.
Yataha.
From whom?
From
whom? Abhavat.
Abhavat.
Emanated.
Emanated.
Vishvam.
Vishvam.
Creation.
Creation.
Idam.
Idam.
This.
This.
Vichitram.
Vichitram.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Samstasyate.
Samstasyate.
Will dissolve.
Will dissolve.
Yatra.
Yatra.
In whom?
In whom?
Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Va.
Va.
Or.
Or.
Avatistate.
Avatistate.
Presently exists.
Presently exists.
Prajapatinam.
Prajapatinam.
Of the Prajapatis.
Of the Prajapatis.
Patihi. The Lord.
Eshaha.
This. Mayam.
To me.
Param.
Highest.
Pramanam.
Authority.
Bhagavan. Supreme Lord.
Anantaha.
Unlimited. Okay, now before we read this verse, just to go back to the other verses. So, Kardama Muni said, any intelligent man would marry this girl. Even the demigods are attracted to her. What to speak of me? And he says, therefore, I will accept her as my wife. But after our children are raised, then I will take up the renounced order. Now, he's giving his reason for his decision. What's his reason for his decision? What's his motive? I mean, he gave as one reason that she's very qualified. Actually, going back a little further, he gave as a reason that he wanted to marry. So, I want to marry. Your daughter's not given her word to anyone. She has a desire for marriage. So he's given all those as his reasons. But now he's saying, param pramana, my highest authority, my highest reason. All these reasons are true, but this is my highest reason. And by saying prajapatinam patir, he's also giving an indication of what somebody else might consider to be his reason, which is not. Who is Prajapati? His father, Lord Brahma. There's many persons called Prajapati, but there's also, particularly Prajapati is Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma wanted his children all to... What do you want all of his children to do?
To get married and expand.
To get married and have lots and lots and lots of children. To fill up the universe. That was his desire. By the way, that's a normal desire. Most of us who have children want our children to have children. Right? That's normal. So this was the... What to speak of if the universe is empty and that's your job. So not only just a view of a father in general, but that's his particular service, is to fill the universe. Translation. The highest authority for me is the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom this wonderful creation emanates and in whom its sustenance and dissolution rest. He is the origin of all Prajapatis, the personalities meant to produce living entities in this world. So his ultimate authority, his ultimate reason for doing anything is God, and he's defining God as the person who's unlimited, the person who creates, maintains, and dissolves everything, and the source of the Prajapatis. So in case anybody would wonder, you know, who's God? How are you defining God? Srila Prabhupada's purport. Kardama Muni was ordered by his father, Prajapati, to produce children. In the beginning of creation, the Prajapatis were meant to produce the large population which was to reside in the planets of the gigantic universe. But Kardama Muni said that although his father was Prajapati, who desired him to produce children, actually his origin was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, because Vishnu is the origin of everything. He's the actual creator of this universe. He is the actual maintainer, and when everything is annihilated, it rests in him only. This is the conclusion of Srimad Bhagavatam. For creation, maintenance, and annihilation, there are three deities, Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshwar, Shiva. But Brahma and Maheshwar are qualitative expansions of Vishnu. Vishnu is the central figure. Vishnu, therefore, takes charge of maintenance. No one can maintain the whole creation but he. There are innumerable entities, and they have innumerable demands. Yes? Even each of us, do we have innumerable are demands too great to number? No one but Vishnu can fulfill the innumerable demands of all the innumerable living entities. Brahma is ordered to create and Shiva is ordered to annihilate. The middle function, maintenance, is taken charge of by Vishnu. Kardama Muni knew very well by his power in progressive spiritual life that Vishnu, the personality of Godhead, was his worshipful deity. Whatever Vishnu desired was his duty, and nothing else. He was not prepared to beget a number of children. Now, of course, how many children did he have?
Ten.
So this is a very interesting statement Prabhupada's making in this purport. He was not prepared to beget a number of children. He would beget only one child, Did that happen?
No.
Who would help the mission of Vishnu. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, whenever there is a discrepancy in the discharge of religious principles, the Lord descends on the surface of the earth to protect religious principles and to annihilate the miscreants. Okay, now Prabhupada's talking about there the desire of Lord Brahma versus the desire of Vishnu and Kariyama Muni's relationship to them. Now he's speaking about not just the desire of Lord Brahma, but one's personal situation in the law of karma in the universe. So, the last paragraph of this purport. He says, marrying and begetting a child is considered to liquidate one's debts to the family in which one is born. There are many debts which are imposed upon a child just after birth. There are debts to the family in which one is born, debts to the demigods, debts to the pitas, debts to the rishis, etc. But if someone engages only in the service of the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead, who is actually worshipful, then even without trying to liquidate other debts, one becomes free from all obligations. Kardama Muni preferred to devote his life as a servant of the Lord in Paramahamsa knowledge and to beget a child only for that purpose, not to beget numberless children to fill up the vacancies in the universe. Yato bhavan vishvam idam vichitram samstasyate yatra tava vatistite prajapatinam patireva mayam param pramanam bhagavan ananta. The highest authority for me is the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom this wonderful creation emanates and in whom its sustenance and dissolution rest. He is the origin of all Prajapatis, the personalities meant to produce living entities in this world. So this verse and purport are essentially about who we should be trying to please. And we talked about this yesterday in Srimana Shiksha in terms of Dharma and Adham. To give up Dharma and Adham. That we identify in this world, generally, we identify in terms of Dharma. That's perhaps decreasing. More and more people perhaps are identifying in terms of Adharma. But we can say that human beings, as a general principle, identify in terms of Dharma. Dharma is related to your identity in terms of the body. We're talking about Varnashram Dharma. I'm a child. My duty is to please my teachers, my parents. In youthful life, my duty is to please my spouse. My duty is to please my parents still, my government, my employer, my employees, my children. I'm in middle age, and my duty is to please my children, my grandchildren, maybe take care of my aging parents. Now, these are my identities. And this relates to I am a something. I am a son. I am a daughter. I am a wife. I am a husband. I am a mother. I am a father. I am a banker. I am a computer programmer. I am a custodian. I am a prime minister. Whatever. We have these designations according to ashram and varna, according to our family, according to our occupation, according to the world. Or even I am a member of the Hare Krishna movement in Perth, Australia. And then we take the idealized form of that. What would a good member of the Hare Krishna movement in Perth, Australia do? What would a good son do? What would a good wife do? And we try to do that. And that's how we make our decisions. Should I buy this thing? Should I not buy this thing? Well, I'm a husband and a father and a banker. What would I do? And it can even be, you know, I'm an Indian husband. And I'm an American housewife. I remember visiting a family where they had just moved into their first house, and they were eating at the kitchen area, and they said, "Well, you know, it's acceptable to eat here when you just bought the house, but I think, you know, most middle class Americans would have a dining room table at least by their second year in the house." So I thought that very interesting. So the husband was basically saying, "If I'm a good American husband. If I'm a good American middle-class husband, I will have a dining room table by the time I'm 2 years in the house." And this is how we go on with our life. Are we going to buy a car? What car are we going to buy? How many sets of clothes do we have? I remember people became devotees, and they were already a married couple, and the husband was a little bit more interested in Krishna consciousness than the wife at that particular time. And his wife was pretty much just coming to Krishna consciousness, and he said to me, how many saris should a married woman have? And so I went to my closet and I counted. I said, I have 12. I said, but my neighbor has 40. You know, so I am a married Hare Krishna devotee in such and such a climate. How many saris do I have? And that's how we make our decisions. We make our decisions by identity and who we're trying to please. If I'm a member of the Hare Krishna movement in Perth, Australia, then I'm trying to please my temple president in Perth, Australia. I'm not trying to please the temple president in Zagreb, Croatia. And though the people that I'm trying to please certify that I am who I am. Yes, you are a very good member of ISKCON Perth. Yes, you are a very good wife. Yes, you are a very good daughter. Of course, they don't always do that. In fact, they often don't do that. The other people in our life who we are trying to please generally don't even recognize what we do to please them at all. They generally don't even see it. Generally just completely oblivious to it. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. If they see things, they just see the result. They don't see the effort or the intention. Or they even misread the intention. Even if they say, well, yeah, you did that, but the only reason you did that was because of this. So they misread our intentions. They certainly don't see our sacrifices. They just don't. They're basically unaware of them. And you always know when somebody's fishing for appreciation in terms of their identity because they'll start enumerating their sacrifices. They'll start saying, well, you know, I was up from 2 this morning and I cleaned the whole kitchen. And they'll start going through all of their invisible sacrifices. What are they trying to get? They're trying to get somebody to say, yes, you are a very good, whatever your particular identity is. And then, as I said yesterday, we're also always evaluating ourselves. Am I really a good son? Do I call my mother enough? Am I actually taking care of her properly? Am I really a good father? So we were constantly doing this. And what is the result of trying to please all these various persons and organizations and groups of people? What's the result?
Feeling bad about yourself.
Generally feeling bad about yourself. Occasionally feeling good about yourself. Occasionally you say, yes, wow, I was really a good mother today. But generally we fall short, isn't it? I mean, how many days of the year can we really say, wow, today I was a good devotee, I was a good wife, I was a good mother, I was a good employee, I was just a good everything. Tick off all the boxes. How many days a year can we say that?
Not many.
Not very many. Not very many. You know, we can always find some reason why we fall short. And how many days a year do all the other people in our life that are supposed to be telling us how good we are in all these things, do they feel that way? Not very many. What to speak of when everyone else feels that way and we feel that way. So maybe someone else can say to us, wow, you're such a sincere devotee. And our mind goes, no, I'm not. You should have been there an hour ago when I was yelling at my kid. Right? So it's very rare that both the assessment of other people and our own self-assessment actually make us feel good about our false material temporary identity. And the reason for that is it's a false temporary material identity, which we're never going to feel really good about because it's not who we are. It's as absurd as saying, I'm really trying to be a good whale. You know, it's madness. I'm trying to be a good kangaroo, you know. It's not who I am. It's madness. If Prabhupada said it's all madness. So who are we? What is wrong with my brain? Oh, give me the verse. I know this verse. Jivera Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasa. We are always simply Krishna's servant. That's our only identity. We don't really have another identity. I mean, there's specificity in that identity. Some of us are Krishna servants as flowers, and some of us are Krishna servants as cows, and some of us are Krishna servants as young gopis, and some of us are Krishna servants as older gopis or cowherd boys. We have specificity in that identity, which awakens gradually in our progression of Krishna consciousness. But regardless of the specificity of that identity, the only person that we are really trying to please is Krishna, and our only identity is in relationship to Krishna. And that's all. The nectar of devotion, Bhishma says, prema is your love, is totally reposed upon Krishna. Rupa Goswami says, all feelings of kinship are reposed in the Lord. And this is what Kardama Muni is saying here. My only boss is the Lord. I don't have any other boss. I am not getting married and having children to fulfill my material debts. I'm not getting married and having children even to please my father, Lord Brahma, who wants to fill up the universe with countless living entities. I'm not really interested in that, he said. That's not my purpose. My purpose is not just to fill the universe, even with nice people. Just like Daksha, he wanted to fill the universe with nice people. He wanted to fill the universe with people who would fill the universe with people who were all nice. Right? And that's very much the mood of the mode of passion. Bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more. And Lord Brahma is the qualitative incarnation of the mode of passion. He has some desire for this. And it appears that his master is Lord Brahma. It's the beginning of the universe. He's one of the sons of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is saying, get married and fill the universe. Now, of course, Lord Brahma wants high-quality children. He doesn't want the universe filled with troublesome children, as happened at some points in the creation also. But Lord Brahma's mood, which is also a service, but Lord Brahma's mood is very much in this mode of passion. That's bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more. You know, when I ran Gurukulas, which I did for many, many years in the movement, guess what the first question that people would ask me about the school was? 99% of the time. How many students do you have? It was very, very rare that anyone asked me another question for their first question. How many students do you have? Bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more. Quantity, 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 quantity. How many books do you distribute? How much money do you collect? How many people come to the program? How many plays did you distribute? Bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more. Expand, expand, expand. The Kshatriya idea is, you know, get another kingdom, get another kingdom, get another kingdom. Take care of more people. The Vaishya who's in passion and ignorance is, make more money. Business is successful. Expand it. Hire more people. Make more money. Bigger, 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 bigger. And especially the Western countries are very much in this mood of expansion and bigger. And you know, the modern society is always better, 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 better. It's a better car, it's a better TV, it's a better phone, it's a better shoe, it's a better textile. It's a better shampoo. Right? It's we're always improving, 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 improving. So this is Lord Brahma's business. But the real master is not Lord Brahma. The real master is Vishnu. And Vishnu is in charge of sattva-gun and maintenance. The mood of sattva-gun is quite different. The mood of sattva-gun is balance, satisfaction, simplicity, harmony, mercy, forgiveness, and quality. Goodness is interested in quality. You can have one moon, one great personality, one Srila Prabhupada, one Jesus Christ, one Narada Muni is enough. One moon instead of many stars. Prabhupada would say, if my movement produces one pure devotee, then I would consider myself a success. One perfect chanting of Hare Krishna. When I heard Prabhupada give a class in 1975 in Philadelphia, so he was reading from a manuscript of the sixth canto, and the devotees were reading the manuscript. And Prabhupada would have the devotees read the verse and the purport, and the devotee reading the purport. There's a recording of this class, you can hear. said, then Jamila cried out three times, Narayana, Narayana, Narayana. And Prabhupada said, what is this three times? He said, I did not say three times. He said, once is sufficient, Narayana. So the mood of the Lord is maintenance, balance, quality. Of course, the Lord is also dynamic. And the Lord is also big. And the Lord is also expanding. That's a fact. The Lord is constantly expanding, and He has unlimited living entities and unlimited rasa. But that's not in the mode of passion. That's an expansion of love and harmony. And there's never the way the Lord expands and the Lord's bigness spiritually is never quantity at the expense of quality. It's not like that. You can see how with industrialization we went more into the mode of passion, with factories, instead of some beautiful handmade object that was full of love and craftsmanship and skill, and that gave the Shudra great satisfaction. Then everybody's just in the factory doing mindless work all day, because we want quantity over quality. So that's a tendency of the mode of passion. Just churn them out. Just look at the numbers. So Kardama Muni, he said, look, Vishnu's going to be happy if I have one amazing child. If I have one child who's a ray of Vishnu, if I have one child who's an incarnation, if I have one child who's an enlightened soul, Vishnu will be happy. And Lord Brahma might not be happy, but that's not my problem. My problem is pleasing Lord Vishnu. And Vishnu wants me to produce a child who'll change the universe. But that wasn't the result. The result wasn't that he just had Lord Kapila Dev. The result was, first he had 9 daughters. And these daughters were married to sages under the jurisdiction of Lord Brahma. And these daughters populated the universe, just as Lord Brahma wanted. And then he also had Lord Kapila Dev. So he satisfied Lord Vishnu, and he also satisfied Lord Brahma. He didn't end up not satisfying Lord Brahma. No, that might have happened. But generally, when we work to satisfy Vishnu, Vishnu takes care of satisfying other people if he wants to. That's his business, not mine. If I work to satisfy the company president then is in charge of satisfying the other workers in the company. That's his problem. It's not my problem. And he may engage me in a way that satisfies the other members of the company. But that's not my aim. My aim is just to satisfy the president of the company. I don't have any other aim. I'm not trying to satisfy my coworkers and my customers independent of satisfying the present. Although they may also be satisfied with me. Lord Vishnu says, fine. You're dedicating your grahastha life to me. You're dedicating your body to me. Okay. I also want to satisfy Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu is saying, because after all, Lord Brahma has this instruction from Vishnu. It's not just some independent desire. Lord Brahma's desire to fill up the universe is Vishnu's desire. So therefore, everything was taken care of. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes when we just try to satisfy Krishna, other people are not happy with us. And sometimes some people are happy with us, and some people are not happy with us. And by the way, that happens whether we try to satisfy Vishnu or not. It's not that if you say, well, if I'm not going to satisfy Vishnu, I'm going to satisfy everybody independently, as we talked about in the beginning. It's not that that's going to work. You say, well, if I just try to satisfy Lord Vishnu, other people may not be happy with me. But other people may not be happy with you anyway. In fact, nobody's going to be entirely happy with any of us if we try to satisfy them independently. I'll stake my life on that. None of us will be able to 100% satisfy another jiva independently of the Lord. Ever. We could sacrifice our life for billions of lifetimes to satisfy one particular jiva, and that jiva would never say to us, I am completely satisfied. Because we don't have the capacity. It's like trying to light the room with your phone. The need of every jiva is for the Lord, and I am not the Lord. Therefore, I do not have the capacity to satisfy another jiva. I do not have the capacity to satisfy myself. No matter how intelligent I am, no matter how hardworking I am, no matter how dedicated I am, no matter how self-sacrificing I am, no matter how loving I am, no matter how many books I read and how many courses I take and how many lifetimes I go through and how many different bodies I have, I don't have the capacity to satisfy myself, nor do I have the capacity to satisfy anybody else. I have the capacity, however, to satisfy Krishna. Not because I have the capacity exactly, but because he's satisfied by very little from the jiva. He doesn't require a lot to be satisfied from the jiva. Just like a parent doesn't require a lot to be satisfied by a very young child. Maybe by a 20-year-old child, but not by a 2-year-old or 3-year-old child. It just doesn't take much. You know, or a 2-month-old baby. A smile is sufficient. The 2-month-old baby smiles, the parents are satisfied. My godbrother Gopa Vrindapal Prabhu told me that when one of his sons was 6 years old, the son picked up a stick and came to him and said, "Daddy, Daddy, here's a stick for you." And he said he felt completely satisfied. And then he could understand, this is what Krishna's like. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta bhajati. Tadaham bhakti paritam ashrami paritasma. Krishna's satisfied by a flower. Krishna's satisfied by a little water. I give the example all the time that when I visit devotees' homes, when I stay at devotees' homes or visit them, they usually have little cups of water on their altar for their deities. Sometimes these cups are very, very small. On your altar, they're very small. How tall would you say it? Maybe 1.5 centimeters tall, right? So I was one time visiting a devotee's house where they had very, very, very small deities. Like maybe a small Jagannath. You know how you see these tiny little Jagannath deities? And the cups of water that they had were maybe a third the size of your cups. Just imagine how small they were. They were so small, I was amazed that they didn't lose them. And each little cup only held one eyedropper drop of water. But Krishna's satisfied. You give him a little cup with an eyedropper full, you know, one tiny drop of water. What Krishna is satisfied with is our intention and our loving mood. He's not particularly concerned about the results because we're not in control of the results, and he already has everything. He already is everything. So satisfying Krishna only requires anukulena Krishna anushivumam bhaktiyut. Anukulena. It only requires the intention to please him. That's all it requires. Prabhupada says in Nectar Devotion, all that's required is sincerity. Now, of course, if we're sincere, we don't just sit around saying, "Krishna, I'd like to please you." We actively, shilanam, we actually do something to please him. But if we think that what we're doing to please him is what's pleasing him, we've missed the entire point. I can't really do anything to please him. First of all, he doesn't need anything. Second of all, whatever I'm doing, he's giving me the ability to do. You understand? Third of all, it's probably a lot more trouble to have me do it than for him to just do it himself. So it's not the result that I'm offering that's pleasing him. It's not, you know, do I distribute 20 books or one book? Or do I make, you know, a killer lasagna like we just had the other day in Sydney? One of the devotees just made this most amazing lasagna I've ever had in my life. Because Krishna was pleased by Vidura's banana peels. And Lord Ramachandra was pleased by Shabari's bitten into berries. That doesn't mean that we should intentionally offer banana peels and bitten into berries. It doesn't mean we should, again, just lie on our couch saying, "I'd like to please you, Krishna." But the point is that we can please Krishna. We can please Krishna because he's very kind and he's pleased very easily by us. And we can never please another jiva no matter how much endeavor we make. Not fully. We can please them temporarily to some extent. But we can't really fulfill their needs. So why not please Krishna? And what happens when we please Krishna is, guess what? We feel completely satisfied. Even if theoretically I could please another jiva completely. Let's say I could do that. Let's say I could act in such a way that another jiva was completely, totally, absolutely satisfied with me and felt totally fulfilled. Guess what? That wouldn't totally fulfill me. But if I just give Krishna a little water, if I just give Krishna a little fruit, if I'm just happy to see Krishna, then I feel completely fulfilled. And Krishna can arrange, if he wants, that my action to please him also satisfies others. He may. He may not. And Prabhupada would say, pleasing Krishna pleases everybody. But we see practically that not everybody is pleased when we please Krishna. We see that practically. In fact, you know, like Hirani Kashipu wasn't pleased with Prahlad. Even that your nearest and dearest people, this is one of our big frustrations in the Hare Krishna movement, that sometimes the greatest opposition we get are from the other devotees. And it's very confusing. You know, we're doing some service that Srila Prabhupada specifically says he wants to have done, we're doing a service that's in the scriptures. All the devotees should be happy with us. And we would expect that we would get opposition from non-devotees, that we're expecting. But we get opposition from the devotees. Have any of you experienced this? The very people who give you the hardest time and criticize you the most and are the most unappreciative are the people that you expect are going to say, yes, this is wonderful. It's really odd. So, you know, sometimes it may happen that everybody's happy by your service to the Lord. And sometimes it may not. Generally, when we please the Lord, some people are pleased, and some people are not, and some people are all different varieties of pleased. But if that's how we're measuring our pleasure of the Lord, then we're also going to be very frustrated. So we should work just to satisfy Lord Vishnu. Let him worry about whether or not other people are pleased. It's not our problem. It's not, that's not our concern. At all. It never was our job, it never was our service, it never was our capacity, it never was our dharma. Those things are only our dharma if we identify with something that is false. If I identify with something that is false, then I create, what does it say in the Bhagavatam, these self-created duties. We're trying to clear away our self-created duties. We imagine our duties and then we try to fulfill them. And you could say, well, if I just try to please Krishna and I don't try to please anybody else, then won't I be nasty to everybody and hard-hearted? Well, no, because Krishna says if you want to please me, you have to be kind to everybody. Krishna doesn't say if you want to please me, you know, treat everybody like dirt. You won't find that in the scripture anywhere, in any scripture, anywhere. When Jesus was asked, what is the law in summary? He said to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and to love your neighbor as yourself. He said these are the only two things that constitute the law. In fact, you can't say you're trying to please Krishna if you're not kind to all living entities. If you see anyone as an enemy, Ajatashastra, like you used to, if you see anyone as an enemy, you're not pleasing to Krishna. Krishna says, see friends and enemies as neutral, all with an equal eye. If you discriminate between my people and someone else's people, Vijayavinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hasani Suni Chandasa Pankaja Pandita Sankarsha. You say, oh, this is my people, I'm going to please them. But these are not my people, I'm not going to please them. Then you're not going to please Krishna. I'm going to take care of the people, I'm not going to take care of the cows. I'm not going to take care of the dogs, I'm not going to take care of the trees. Then you can't please Krishna. But we're doing those things to please Krishna. That is the difference. We're kind to people, not so people will like us, and not so people will certify our mundane false identity. But we're kind to people so Krishna will say, thank you very much. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions?
I have a question, but it's maybe I can ask later, because it's in regards to the creation.
Which was mentioned here, but I didn't talk about it. Go ahead. It's in the purport. As long as it's in the verse and purport, that's fine.
So, you know how Lord Brahma says, go and create the...
Yes.
So, obviously, there are other species of life as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, with humans, obviously, before, it also says that when you come from the species, you come
to Lord Brahma,
yes. And then later on. So, what stage the other species come into effect? Is it like the other species were there in the beginning, or they came later? Because as we fall down...
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, the entities that are in each creation are generally left over from the previous creation. They were just sleeping. And they come back into the body that they left off at. They're just like asleep. It's explained in the fifth canto that Anantasesha just gets disgusted and says, you know, I've gone through all this trouble of the material world just to help you go back to home, back to Godhead, and you're just messing the whole thing up. And so he just burns the whole thing down. And then eventually he has mercy again, and he says, all right, let's try it again. And then living entities come back, and they go back into the body where they left off. But these daughters of Kardama Muni and the daughters of Daksha, they are producing all different species. And these are not humans, really. Kardama Muni and Devahuti, they're not humans. They're devas. They're very elevated devas. Kardama Muni is the son of Lord Brahma, and Devahuti is the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva Manu and his wife are actually expansions of Lord Brahma. So these are very high. These Prajapatis, they're higher than Indra and Chandra, etc., and they have the capacity to create entities different from their own forms. So we can only create an entity that's like our form. You know, Darwin's idea was that beings can create beings that are different than themselves. But his idea was that you could create beings that are better than yourselves. And that's why Judah Karma wrote this book, Human Devolution, that the demigods can create beings equal to or lesser than themselves. They can't create beings that are higher.
Glancing, or is it through?
It generally through sexual reproduction, but they have other means as well. The children of Lord Brahma were all created in without a sexual partner. So they were created from his thumb, from his shadow, from his mind, from his heart, and so forth. But then after that, he expanded himself into another form that split into Swayambhuva Manu and his wife's name, Sadarupa, I believe. And then they had union and they produced Uttanapad and Devahuti. Priyavata. And then Devahuti, by marrying Kardama, who's born, I think, from Lord Brahma's shadow, they produce daughters who marry these sages that came from Lord Brahma.
Could also produce, like in case of Draupadi, she was produced from the...
Well, you talk about children being produced in other ways. So Draupadi coming out of the fire. Yeah, there's some unusual... Vishwamita Muni was producing children on trees like coconuts. But Lord Brahma told him to stop. He said, don't produce children like that. I mean, Draupadi coming out of the fire was interesting because the idea was the payasa was meant to be eaten by the woman, and then after union with her husband, she would produce a child. As Rudai Nandamar said, it was the ancient clomid. You know, now they give the woman some hormones or something, in the way she can conceive what she can't conceive naturally. But what happened was, during the yajna, Drupad's wife decided to go take a bath in the middle of the yajna. I don't know, maybe it was a very long yajna, maybe she had to use the toilet, I don't know. Why she decided to take a bath. So she left the yajna in the middle, and she was bathing. She wasn't back yet. And the priest, you know, he was ready to take the payasa and give her the payasa. It was the place in the ceremony. But she wasn't there. And he didn't want to wait for her. So instead of waiting for her and giving it to her, he just threw it right in the fire. And then you had Draupadi and Dhristajumna came out of the fire. Instead of... You know, they were still considered the children of Drupad and his wife. So they could do that, those sort of really amazing things. But they generally didn't. They generally didn't, you know, the Brahmanas didn't generally throw prayasa in the fire and have children pop out of the fire, wasn't it? They're normal. But they had all sorts of amazing reproduction and assisted reproduction techniques mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Yes?
You mentioned something a little bit before. It's a little bit subtle or vague, but how is Prabhupada's idea of, you know, within ISKCON, different groups dealing with each other? You know, did you have the competition thing, you know, my group's better than yours, or how do you deal with those?
Oh, okay. Well, there's a kind of spiritual competition to please Krishna that has no envy or malice in it. And there was a festival day when I was a fairly new member of ISKCON. There was a festival day. I have no recollection of what day it was at all. I don't remember what particular festival day it was. I'd only been in the movement maybe a month or two, so that explains why I didn't remember at all what festival day it was. But I remember I was in the Chicago Temple in Evanston. I'm sure it's not the same building anymore. There was a corridor, and on one side of the corridor was the kitchen, and the other side of the corridor was wasn't exactly the pujari room, but it was a room where we would do things for the deities. It was the room where we would make garlands, we would make ghee wigs, we would wash the deities' silver. There was no sink in there. We would have to bring in big tubs of water to do the polishing, we would transfer the plates in there. So it was kind of like a pujari room, but sort of like that. And we had one kitchen in ISKCON temples in those days. It was one kitchen. Everything was offered to the deities. There was no concept of a deity kitchen and a devotee kitchen. So there were a whole bunch of devotees in the kitchen cooking, and there were a whole bunch of us in this other room. I don't remember what we called that room, but there was a lot of us in that other room, and some of us were making garlands, and some of us were sewing an outfit for the deities for the festival day, and some of us were polishing the silver. And I don't remember who started the kirtan. My guess is it was a devotee named Lakshmi Narayan. That's my guess. I'm not sure. I don't recollect that. But the kirtan was going on in these two rooms, although they were separated by a corridor. And everybody was engaged in chanting. And as we were engaged in this kirtan, which went on, again, in my recollection, for several hours, the feeling, at least that I had, was that we were all enlivened by each other's very different service and trying to do our best in that service, being enlivened by the other's service. So those of us who were making garlands were feeling enlivened by those who were cooking, and those who were sewing, and those who were sewing were feeling enlivened by those who were making garlands, and those who were cooking, and those who were cooking were enlivened by those who were making garlands. That it was a mood like that, that everybody was really trying to do. At least that was how I felt. I don't know if everybody else felt that way, but that was how I perceived it. That we were all in the same kirtan, and we were all serving the same lords, Kishore Kishori, in different ways. And everybody else's energy and investment in their service was enlivening everybody else. That's one example. Another example was, this is in New York Temple. So we had an interesting, it was very spontaneous. So in New York Temple on 55th Street, there were about 300 devotees living in the temple. And we also had so many guests come that every Mangalarti was probably about 500 or 600 people, because so many guests were coming regularly. Our Sunday feast, we could seat 600 people at a time, and we had to serve the prasadam twice because we couldn't fit all the guests at one time. We couldn't fit all six, you know, we only fit 600, 1,200. It was a very enlivened and enlivening temple. So one day, for reading of the deities, the devotee who was leading the kirtan left the temple room and took the whole kirtan party out with him. And he took the kirtan party all throughout the temple. He took the kirtan party down to the humongous kitchen. I mean, that kitchen was at least as big as this temple, if not bigger. It was probably considerably bigger. And the devotees started playing the pots and pans in the kirtan. And then he took the kirtan up. We had, besides the basement where it was the restaurant and the kitchen and the bakery, He took the Kirtan party up through all the floors. There were 11 floors and then a 12th, which was the roof. And we didn't go on the roof, I don't think. We went through all the 11 floors with the Kirtan. There was no Bhagavatam class that day. The Kirtan just went on and on and on, and then we had breakfast. And that just happened. And then sometime later, it happened again with a different Kirtan leader. I always wondered if they chose the days to do that when the Kirtan leader didn't like who was scheduled to give the Bhagavatam class. That was always my suspicion. But because it seemed to happen on particular days with particular speakers. But this would just happen, you know, it would just happen. And the Kirtan would overflow, and if you can imagine, you know, hundreds of devotees having this very wild Kirtan that was going up the stairs. Some people would take the lift up and down the stairs and through all of the hallways. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was our GVC, and he decided that he was going to systematize this. So it still happens sometimes spontaneously in the morning and sometimes also in the evening kirtan. But he made every Monday in the evening, I'm pretty sure it was in the evening, that every Monday evening the little Radha Krishna deities would be taken in procession with the kirtan throughout the building. So then it became something a little bit more organized and sober. It was still pretty wild, but it was relatively speaking more organized and sober. And so the deities went, you know, one floor at a time through everything with this kirtan procession. Well, when we knew it was going to happen, it was scheduled, then what happened again spontaneously, I don't remember anybody planning this or anybody saying it or anybody asking us to do it, but if the deities are going to come through the whole temple and they're going to come down through the whole hall, they're going to go past your room. And so, you know, somebody got the idea that instead of just following the kirtan party, they would be at their room. And that when the deities came by, they would offer them something. I know in Vrindavan, when Prabhupada circumambulates the temple, Devi Shakti always stands at the door of her shop and offers Prabhupada some incense and a flower. I don't remember if she was at 55th Street. But that was the kind of thing that we did. We would stand at our door. Of course, you opened your door, which meant your room was... What did you do to your room? You cleaned your room, yes. So again, nobody said this is going to be our Maha cleanup day. But it happened because the deities were going all over the temple and it was scheduled, so everybody cleaned and they cleaned their room and they might be in the procession, but when the procession got to your floor, we had two floors for the brahmacharis, I think one for the brahmacharinis, one for the householders without children, one for the householders with children, one for visiting sannyasis and VIP devotees, one for guests, one for Srila Prabhupada, one for Back to Godhead, one for the theater, etc. So when you were in the kirtan party and they came to your floor, you would run ahead and you'd go to your room and you'd open the door and you'd have some boga or you'd have some incense or something like that to offer to the deities. So that went on for a while. And there was a little bit of a sense of competition as to who could greet the deities nicer at their door. And then I don't know, again, who came up with this idea, but somebody, and I don't remember what floor it started with, someone decided that why don't we greet the deities for our floor? So one Monday, when the deities came to a particular floor, again, I can't remember how it started at all, the residents of that floor did something special. They chanted a bunch of mantras, or they had a bunch of flower petals, or something like that. Well, once one floor did that, then all the other floors became excited. And then the residents of each floor, each week, would get together, maybe not everybody, and figure out what were we going to do to greet the deities. And remember one time we decided to decorate our floor. We were on the 9th floor. That was the Grahasthas with Children floor. And I remember going to Central Park and collecting a whole bunch of leaves and branches. And we decorated the whole floor with leaves and branches. Sometimes the devotees would do a drama. The deities would get to the deities were going usually in the lift. And the lift doors would open, and the devotees on that floor were doing a drama, or they were doing, you know, they were singing bhajans, or they would have silka recitation, or all different kinds of decorations. And it became an informal competition. And after a while, the temple authorities actually announced winners of the competition. So that's the kind of thing that goes on in the spiritual world. And by the way, this was all spontaneous. It was not you know, and even the planned things, even Wirtta Mahakrishnamurti's plan that the deities would go around every Monday, that grew from something that was spontaneous. And I don't recall there being any malice or envy involved. It was so much fun. It was just so much fun. Every week you tried to think of a different way to greet the deities that you hadn't done before and that no one else had done before. And it was, this is what's going on in the spiritual world.
We actually sell that building.
Yes. So that kind of competition. If I told you everything about that building, you would cry. Everybody would just sit here and cry. We had a full-on professional theater, actual professional theater. Sound booth and professional lighting, and all the curtains and the dressing rooms and all of that. We had full-on offices for Bhakti Godhead. We had a restaurant that seated 150 people with a professional-level kitchen. Big restaurant kitchen. We had also a professional bakery. We had a store that was on street level, so people could just walk in from the street to the store. We had a whole like reception desk in the front entrance way. We had a VIP guest room on the main floor, and then our temple room was so big we could fit probably 2,000 people in that temple. That was beautiful, beautiful temple, just gorgeous, absolutely. And all you had to do to distribute books was walk out the door. Because we were by Broadway and 55th Street in Manhattan. So and you walked out the door and there was literally a million people were walking past you. You know, literally, actually, really. So it was very, if you wanted to do book distribution for an hour, that took you an hour. You understand? You didn't have to go anywhere. So when my daughter was 1 month old, I could, you know, put her down for a nap, ask one of the other ladies to watch her, go down in the lift, distribute books right outside the temple for an hour, go back up the lift, you know, and my baby was still sleeping.
Not just that, everything in one place.
Yeah. And right in the central part of the most important city. The central part of Manhattan.
The temple's still there now?
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, I was telling you the story. Not so we'd cry about that. That's long over. But so I would understand some idea of what is spiritual competition. It was like that. Yes.
Everyone's supposed to be satisfied, but sometimes it doesn't happen like that. But still, our aim should be, like, the utmost aim should be to please him. Of course, we try to please everyone else, but it just seems like this.
No, don't try to please anybody else.
You can't.
Don't try to please anybody else. At all. Mm-hmm. Don't try to please anybody else. Try to only please Krishna. It'll look like you're trying to please other people, but you're not. You're trying to please other people to please Krishna. You're not trying to please other people to please other people. It'll look, practically speaking, the same from the outside, except you'll be a very happy, peaceful person who's not disturbed by relationships in this world. That will be the primary way that you can judge and others can say, oh, you have the right object. But your external behavior with others won't be very different. If you're trying to please your husband to please Krishna, you're still going to cook your husband's favorite foods. But because that's what Krishna wants you to do, not because that's what your husband wants you to do. And that's how you'll be a good wife. You're not trying to be a good wife. You're trying to simply please Krishna. Now, how do you know that? You know that if when other people say your false identity is no good, you're not disturbed by it. Because that wasn't what you were trying to get. some person on the street says to me, you know, you're not a good devotee. Well, I care what they say. I'm not trying to please them. Now, if they say that because I've done something terrible that's shameful to Krishna, then I would care because I'd understand all Krishna's problems. I haven't represented him myself. But the main way you can tell is in how you're affected by other people's dealings with you and what your source of satisfaction is. The externals are going to look almost identical to somebody who's just being dharmic. It's not really, like Prabhupada wrote in one letter, you know, if you're unhappy with others, it's not their lack of Krishna consciousness, it's yours. If I'm dissatisfied with how other people deal with me, it's because I have the wrong object of worship. That doesn't mean that nobody's actions are wrong. If someone deals with me in an, you know, ungrateful, nasty way, my not being affected by that doesn't make their behavior okay. But the effect on me is going to be either nil or very slight and transient. There may come some dissatisfaction in the mind, like when Judd Barrett was insulted by King Rahugana, because the mind's still under the modes of nature. So the mind would go, but it's just rivers flowing into the ocean. It doesn't. You're just the observer. Oh yes, the mind becomes dissatisfied when I'm ill-treated, but that's not me. You don't identify with it. You don't try to grab it, nor do you try to push it away. You just let it flow and go. I'm trying to please Krishna. So that's the main evidence procedure, that we actually have the right object, that we're trying to please the right person we're trying to please. That we don't become affected by the praise or the criticism of the world, the honor and dishonor, the fame and infamy, friends and enemy. It's not that we're unaware of it. And there will be some feelings in the body and the mind. As long as we have a body and mind will respond to those things. But we won't. It will be, as St. Teresa of Avila said, as if you're just the observer of something that has nothing to do with you. Now, that may not be an on and off switch. It may be something that gradually we catch ourselves. Wait a minute, why am I so upset with what's happening? Or why am I so pleased with what's happening? Because it's feeding or hurting my false identity. Wait a minute, that's not what I want to do. So that may be a gradual thing. And then every time we have the right source of pleasure, the right object of serving, then we're like, wow, I'm so peaceful and I'm so happy, regardless of what's going on around me, and regardless of how even my mind is affected. I'm able to transcend my mind and say, oh, that's really nice, I think I'd like to do more of that. And we work and work to do more of it until finally we're there completely. That may take years before we're there 100%. It may not be a 1 week or a 1 month thing. It might be, could be. Could be a 1 week thing, could be a 1 minute thing. But I think for most of us it takes years. But at least to start out with that understanding and to start working on it. And at least to recognize that when we feel, you know, flattered by other people's praise of our false identity. Well, yes. Now finally they're recognized. And when we feel, you know, hurt by people saying, you know, that wasn't very nice. That is because I'm identifying with something that's not me. Is that okay? By the way, for people in general who are not at all God conscious, these false identities are much more helpful than being in the motivations. Far better to get people think you're going to be a good responsible citizen, you're going to be a good responsible mother, than for them just to act like animals. Or worse than animals, because even animals tend to be responsible in their duties. So you can't, if you go to people in general who are not interested in God consciousness, and you just say to them, you know, you don't have to be a good this and a good that, then they'll just say, oh great, you know, then I'll be a bad everything. They'll go into an adharmic identity, not a transcendent identity. So one has to be careful that one explains these things appropriately. For people in general, it may be very useful. Okay, what are you? You are a Vaishya. You are a Vaishya woman. That's who you are.
Okay.
And that's your duty. Do that. Because if you say to them, that's not what you are, oh, great, you know, then I can just party all the time. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.